This is an adult podcast made for adults by adults. We talk about Derek Jarman's Blue on today's podcast, which means a lot of talk on serious stuff like the AIDS crisis and death. We also talk a lot about the color of blue and the very hip and trendy necropolitics. This is Fake Film Fans.
Welcome to Fake Film Fans, a movie podcast for thoughtful degenerate. I'm Suede Breast. Jesus, I just said Suede Breast.
Well, aren't you Suede Breast?
I'm Suede Breast, the king of breasts. And he's the best. The king of breasts. Breast king, 24/7.
I like breasts. I think I like breasts more than you, no?
You have to say your name before the podcast starts, Walter, or I'm going to hurt myself. We can't do the podcast.
Well, I'm Walter, by the way, guys, and I like breasts more than Suede does.
That is true. I am an ass man. I am a butt guy. Also, armpits. Top tier.
Really?
Yeah.
But you like showers.
I just like an armpit. I mean, that's like apples and oranges. What does one have to do with the other?
I usually think people who like armpits like kind of that gushy smell, you know what I mean? So, like, if you like showers, that gushy smell is, like, not available.
I don't have a problem with, like, fresh sweat. I don't want someone to smell like BO. Walter, it's not like I, like, need people to be, like, 100% clean. I need to take a shower every day because it soothes the beasts that live inside my brain.
Yeah, but you always, like, judge people who don't shower enough.
Well, okay, but that's because there's a line. There's a difference between like being a little sweaty and like smelling like you haven't bathed in 3-4 days. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so it sounds like you like clean armpits, which is like a weird fetish, no?
No, I don't think it's that weird. What are you talking about?
Maybe I'm just a dirty motherfucker.
You're doing the 100% kettle pot right here. You're like, I'm only gonna lick an armpit if it's someone who smells like they haven't bathed in 17 years.
Okay, for the listeners, what the fuck is the 100% kettle pot?
Okay, we're gonna do this. All right, so the 100% kettle pot is something Walter's therapist told him. But Walter sort of retranslated it. So what Walter's therapist told him was that, you know, when you have water in a kettle, it just holds it all in until it suddenly boils and it all boils over. And so you're either not letting anything out or it's over boiling 100%. All the steam is coming out. And Walter took all that and said, oh, okay. So it's the 0-100% kettle pot.
Oh, I didn't realize the translation part was actually weird. But yeah, now that you tell it back to me.
And so that became like a thing. That became a thing when we lived together. Was this and something that has actually in my own life that I use this 0-100% kettle pot.
So I want to be a little real to the view. Now, we don't have viewers. We have
unless
listeners.
You're on YouTube. Yo, chat. Yo. We got a lot of views on YouTube, so if you're on YouTube watching this, hell yeah.
Though, if you're on YouTube watching this, you're probably a fan of me and not Suede at all. You're probably just skipping through every single time Suede talks, so I thank you for that, too.
Oh, no! Oh, no! How could you do this to me, YouTube chan?
So, you might have noticed the intro. We've changed a little bit of things around because I want this podcast to be more about films, and it's been a bit of a struggle. So we're going to compromise a little, and
we're parting the kimono.
Start.
We're parting the kimono.
Parting the kimono. Yeah. Because I'm Asian?
Yes.
Okay. I have definitely worn 6 million different types of colors of kimonos.
We're lifting up the large ball gown to show our underwear. To show our fancy lady underwear that is the back of this podcast.
I don't think people who wear kimonos wear underwear, do they?
I don't know. I've never worn a fucking kimono in my life, dude.
Okay, but you've probably upskirted a kimono wearer, haven't you?
I have never upskirted anyone, Walter. That's just fucking criminal. What is wrong with you? No. I've never upskirted anyone. Don't fucking say that shit. Jesus. Have you heard about people like putting mirrors on their shoes so they can like put their foot underneath people who are wearing dresses to like see up their skirt? It seems like a lot of work for not a lot of payoff.
It's a power thing. Well, back then they didn't have porn, so I think that was also
That's a good excuse. Sexual harassment and sexual assault, it's fine because they didn't have porn. Good excuse, Walt. Good.
I just get this feeling that like because porn is just real porn now, that these bad people, some of them have become less bad, not because they're less bad, but because they've just realized they have porn now.
Oh, they have an outlet.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
All right, keep complaining about the podcast that we work so hard on. Keep complaining.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fuck this podcast. But I'm going to do some compromising stuff, and I'm going to try to talk about movies at least a little bit.
And
if we have to talk about Arthur the Fourth 5th and 6th episode of Motherfucking Armor again, we'll still have a little bit of movies for anyone who, like, listens to our movie because, I mean, listens to our podcast because they think it's a movie.
Oh, they listen
podcast
to our movie? Do they listen to our movie, Walter? What movie do they listen to of ours? What movie did we make?
What? I don't know. Fuck it.
We made a movie about how much we support Israel, right? Do you remember at Goucher when the, like, Halal group did that, like, big movie all about how Israel was totally down with the gays? And all the people on the Justice for Palestine Club were also all gay? And so there was, like, this giant-ass protest where they all, like, circled around the library with, like, pink tape over their mouths. And it like, turned into a mini war, the queers v. the Jews.
It was called pinkwashing, just so you remember.
Was that the movie, or that was what people were doing?
That's what people were doing.
Okay, pinkwashing. Okay.
I thought it was a pretty cool moment, because, like, everyone who wasn't part of those two groups had, like, no fucking idea what was going on. So I thought the conversation that came out of those, like, absolute no one knows what the fuck is going on was, like, pretty funny.
I thought it was really funny because anytime, like, Zionists show their hand and, like, show their ass about, like, because there were, like, professors who, like, were, like, telling students of theirs, like, how terrible they were for doing this. So anytime, like, a Zionist asshole shows their hand and, like, is like, oh, so you are a giant asshole, huh? Like, that always makes me happy. It always makes me laugh when it's like, oh, no, you are as terrible as I thought you were.
Oh, so you weren't part of the group that had no idea what was going on. You knew everything.
I always know everything.
With the queers, and I'm with the pink.
I know about queer stuff. I know about pink stuff.
You know, I think we pinkwash our podcast, to be honest.
You think so?
Yeah, I think we only talk about queer movies so queer people will like us, so they forget about our utter atrocities, like our racism, our sexism, our racist sexism. Yeah,
our general negative behavior. I would like to think that, like I said on the last episode, one day we're gonna be rich and famous because of this podcast, and someone's gonna look at the backlog episodes and be like, can you believe they said this? And we're gonna get canceled.
We're not gonna get canceled, because by then
the earth will have melted.
And also, people who get canceled are just weak. They just don't understand how to navigate it. Us, we say things, and it's on the eggshells. So when we backtrack, we'll be able to do some political socializing.
Right, you know, like, you say something fucked up, and then you have an excuse. We're like, well, let's really dissect this. Let's, like, navigate exactly why this was said. Basically making us the worst, but I guess that's fine. You still haven't talked about movies, by the way, Walter, so.
All right, let's fucking talk about some goddamn fucking movies. I have three movies I want to share this week that I watched. The first thing is The Third Man. I'm bringing it up because it's the British film, and I didn't watch it for a very long time.
It's like an old one, too, right? God.
Yeah, like a 40s film. Orson Welles is in it.
And this is pre-super fat Orson Welles, right?
Okay, maybe this is, like, me misunderstanding something, but I read, like, Orson Welles would get super slim for his movies and then become fat immediately afterwards, and then at the end of his life, he just gave up.
The only thing I know about Orson Welles, besides the fact that he's, like, supposed to be a very good movie boy, is that his last film role before he passed away was in the Transformers movie. He played, like, the big, bad, giant planet-sized Transformer. Omicron, maybe?
Wait, that's so fucking interesting. I never fucking knew that. What does that even mean? That what is Transformers, actually? Like, the Transformers we know from Michael Bay?
No, so, you know, the old school Transformers cartoon, the one from, like, the late 80s, early 90s, is, like, for Transformers purists, that's their favorite. And the really big movie, the one that, like, is a super intense tearjerker, has Orson Welles in it. Yeah. And it was actually his last film role. He played Unicron, who's this, like, giant space devil Transformer that's, like, the size of a planet. And he actually passed away before the movie was released, but he finished all his lines.
That's so weird. I wonder if he had a relationship with Transformers or something.
I don't know all that much about it. I just know it's weird that it's his last. It's a little bit like Jim Carrey. I mean, Jim Carrey's still alive, but his last film role was Dr. Eggman.
Yeah, but Orson Welles, like, a pretentious dickhead. Kind of thinking about Transformers, maybe it had some pretentious dickhead vibes before, which is why you wanted to do it.
Well, like, Transformers lore is, like, pretty deep. It is, like, a cash grab franchise, but it's not, like, fucking... No, it is a little bit like Sonic the Hedgehog, in that, like, you can go deep into some Transformers lore.
And then I watched this movie called Demons, directed by Funeral Parade.
That's the Japanese guy, right? Who does those, like, who did that, like, queer...
Funeral Parade of Roses. Yo, but I think this film is, like, up for you because it's about a samurai who, like, takes revenge on this family for, like, taking his money. The tone is super bleak, super wonderful. For the last 15 or so minutes, it's basically the samurai drags this beautiful beheaded woman's head around and, like, also throws it around and stuff and, like, puts it on tables, and it's like girl porn top tier fucking scene. So if I watch this as a 12-year-old boy, I might be into girl.
Oh, guro. So what you're saying is it's disgusting and for degenerates.
Wait, why is girl has to be disgusting and for degenerates?
Are you really asking that? We can't talk about girl on the podcast, Walter.
Well, why is it for degenerates? I feel like you have to be kind of brave. Like, kind of a manly man. You kind of have to go to the gym to enjoy girl.
Dude, because it's literally sexual violence.
Really? I thought girl just was, like, gore and porn.
Yeah, that's sexual violence.
Oh. Actually, that's fair. I never thought about it that way.
We could talk about guro, but I would need time to prepare for that, because there are some guro artists I really like. Shintaro Kago is one, but like there's like a lot that needs to be couched if we want, because I have opinions on it.
I guess the reason why I never thought of it as sexual violence is because a lot of the guro I have experienced on it, it's like porn where the person who is being sexualized is ripping their own skin off, or I see a lot of more self-harm type of guro rather than the
but that's still linking said, that's still linking sex with violence. If we're gonna talk about guro, we gotta couch it. Well, there's like so much.
Okay, then watch Demons and don't get dragged to the dark hole of the girl world.
I mean, I will tell you, I that it reminds you a little bit of Shigurui. I don't know what it is I about the samurai stuff that lends itself to violence so much. I mean, because like so much of samurai violence is class based. You can like fetishize it and turn it into something like really cool, but like at its core, it's a class thing.
I think it's an aesthetic thing. So the swords are thin. You're not bashing armor. It looks cool. A lot of times.
Oh yeah, it's got that Western vibe. I mean, I know Westerns come from samurai movies, but it has that moment. It's a quick strike thing, not like a long drawn out sword fight.
To be honest, the funniest part about that is that I used to hate Westerns. I thought they were like the most boring fucking medium of all time, and it was because there was no action, and then the gunfight, you're expecting like the explosion, and no explosion happened, and I was always like, what the fuck?
It does not have the cathartic blood spray.
I like Westerns a lot now, but
I like modern Westerns. Then, I don't really I don't really love old school Westerns. I do love modern.
Really?
Yeah.
I like the Dollars trilogy. Not the first one. I think that one feels like way too much of a ripoff of Yojimbo, the Kurosawa film. So I just kind of think the first one is basically a racist ripoff.
Oh, spicy.
I actually don't think it changes enough of it to make it fair that it can be called something else and stuff like that.
I've literally just been watching The Mentalist. That's all. I've like had no time for movies.
Is that a TV show?
Yeah, it's a TV show. It's not particularly very good. This guy who's like so good at like figuring out what people are getting ready to do and like predicting what they're gonna do that he like pretends to be a psychic, and he's also like,
forget your name I feel like this forget your name meme, literally the only people who are doing it is this podcast and the VR chat community. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the entire world.
Dude, we gotta get Vebe on the podcast. We gotta get Vebe and Guargura on the podcast.
Vebe's not from the VR chat community though, but I would love to get Vebe.
She's just
a Twitch VTuber.
I'm rereading Yotsuba, by the way. Yotsubato.
Really?
Yeah, I've been feeling a little slow, and I was like, I just want to read something nice and comfy. It makes me want to have a daughter.
To eat.
For blood, yeah. Have a baby, yeah. Eat the baby.
She's
yeah.
also probably very healthy with her green hair, and she holds a clover. I sometimes wonder if Yotsubato would ever finish by the end of our lives.
It's not something that has a cathartic end, necessarily, right? It can't end like Berserk or Naruto or Bleach, where there's like a bad guy to face. It has to end very differently. The closest I can think of is, I think, Sweetness and Lightning, which is another really good slice of life manga, has an end that could work for Yotsuba, where it's like she's grown up now as like a high schooler and like things are...
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, if we're talking about like children and dad stuff, dude, there is fucking the infamous Usagi Drop, which also...
Fuck Usagi Drop. Fuck Usagi Drop. The first half of Usagi Drop is fantastic. But that's what I mean.
Like, you really wanted a linear ending.
I would kill the author if that's how Yotsuba ended. I would go and I would find him. I'd be like, you ruined something perfect. And I would end their life. If you're interested in Usagi Drop, the first section's about a guy who adopts a little girl, and it's very good. And then the second section, I don't know what happened with the author, but the author was like, and what happens if as an adult she falls in love with her adopted dad?
I don't know. I was watching it with and we were watching just the anime, and the anime never gets into the adulthood stuff. So when we were watching it, she like constantly said a few times, ooh, this daughter feels like she does have a relationship with the dad. Maybe there was something a little more sexual about Usagi Drop, even if you didn't even fucking realize.
Maybe it's worth a reread. Maybe it's worth a reread to see.
I love watching daughters marry their dads. Like Woody Allen. And Elon Musk's dad.
And fucking Elon Musk's dad. Jeez. Fucking.
Yeah, but Elon Musk does it director, so we can't, okay, we talk, can't talk about it on the podcast. No, go ahead.
I just dropped one of my guns.
Talk about Elon Musk. What movie is this? Fucking what
it's
movie is this?
It's the Can Apocalypse
fucking
movie.
Guardians of the Galaxy or like House of the Apocalypse? Was that Rob Zombie movie you referenced 600 times too?
It's called House of a Thousand Corpses, Walter. It's good to have a canon of films you can reference, Walter. Oh, 1 second. Let me talk about... Oh, my favorite movie is called Bishojo's Last Resort. And it's 37 hours of just like colors interspersed with Japanese high school girls getting shot by dragons. That's you. That's who
Dude,
you are.
That's literally you with books. I do have to admit, though, that does sound pretty good.
I actually agree. I would watch that. That does sound pretty sweet.
I would love to watch a fucking movie where the dragons are shooting humans and they're like winning.
I mean, I'm sure it's out there. Dragon Apocalypse. We could direct it.
You want to play the dragon or the shoujo girl?
I want to be a bishoujo. I want to be a cute high school girl. We'll get all our guests to be dragons. It can be a chase film. All the guests from our movie will play dragons with guns.
We'll just run around with our fat bellies in the woods. With her little bitty skirts, yeah. And we'll go tump, 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 tump.
Like, oh, no! Oh, no!
People who actually read subtext will realize what's actually happening. It's because most of our guests are people we want to have sex with.
Yeah. You're not allowed from the genesis of this podcast, Walter. From the genesis. The rule is you're not allowed to lewd your co-hosts, Walter. I didn't get a lot of time to watch movies this week is because my car stopped working. And I know, Walter, you live in a world where you kind of don't need a car to get anywhere, and I am very jealous of that. But in Roanoke, you need a car. I mean, it sucks.
The American dream, baby! Well, Five seats in a car because they want 3 kids and 2 adults mm-hmm. and space for 2 kids and 1 dog. And then you drive that car to the national park. That was the only reason why your cars were designed, America. I'm letting you guys know right now.
Or in my case, filled with trash and recycling.
Can you introduce some of your trash friends and family to us?
Yeah, sure. So there's bags of recycling that I take from the bookstore. Those are my sons. And my daughters, who I love much more, are cardboard boxes filled with books that I have taken from various places, either paid for from the bookstore or have been donations that we can't sell in the store. And I keep them because I want them.
Bag's favorite drive-thru is... And then cardboard's favorite drive-thru is...
All of my children's favorite drive-thru is Taco Bell because they're terrible. And we all know that the
best
drive-thru...
I love Taco Bell! What do you mean it's terrible? Taco Bell is the fucking best! The one thing that's actually terrible... Here it comes. Here comes the fucking take. Chipotle fucking blows! Fuck Chipotle! It means nothing. Chipotle means nothing. If you want authentic Mexican food, you go to an authentic Mexican restaurant. If you want non-authentic Mexican food, you go to Taco Bell. When the fuck ever do you go to Chipotle? If you go to Chipotle, you are literally dumb. Your brain
you're
does
so
not
stupid.
Work.
You're worthless. You're an idiot. Because why wouldn't you just go, you'd either get a real good burrito, or you would go to Taco Bell and get like, you know, like a chicken steak chalupa burrito with Doritos and 7-Eleven sauce.
Wait, why you know, you, like, oh, you weren't calling me dumb.
No,
oh,
I agree with you. Sorry. I fucking agree with you, dude. Every once in a while, I will get a hankering for Chipotle, and it was because when we lived on Goucher campus, there was a place that you could get Chipotle-style burritos, and they tasted delicious. So every once in a while, I'll go to Chipotle. But I don't think it's like... It's not like a worthwhile space. I think Chipotle has its place. Anyone who's obsessed with Chipotle is a dumb. On these dating apps, sometimes, like, one of the things that I always see is, like, people are like, what's your first date? Chipotle with extra guac. And I'm like, that's...
Chipotle is a huge one in fucking America. In Asia, in Hong Kong, it's Disney. Every fucking person. Love Disney. I can't even tell which one's worse.
I would rather go to Chipotle than to Disney World. Because at least I can afford a Chipotle.
It fucking disappoints me so much. I hate Asians. I fucking hate Asians, man. They're so disappointing. But I'm fine. I'm calm.
Well, you're Asian.
I'm disappointing.
No, you're not disappointing. You're Asian, and a lot of cars are Asian. For instance, I have a Toyota Camry from 2001. It's an old car, but it works. It's my baby. It's called the Wizmo, short for Wizard Mobile. But so the reason I didn't get to watch a lot of movies today, or this week, was because my car was broken, and I had to get it fixed. Walter, have you ever been in a situation where you needed a car fixed? Like, do you know anything about that?
Yes.
So you know it's an expensive process.
Oh, no. I'm not talking about that stuff. Sorry.
No, fixing cars is like mad expensive if you go to a shop.
Can I tell one story actually? Yeah. When I was really young, I used to play basketball in the domestic league in Hong Kong. I wasn't very good at it, and I also always went to America during the summer, so I could never actually play in the league. I only did the training. But it was so awkward for me. For one, I wasn't good enough to play in the county, like, right next to my home. So we would, like, drive all the way to fucking New Territories, which is the area very close to China.
That's where all the kids are starving, right? All the kids are so, so hungry that they can't even be good at basketball. Part of the reason they would lose is because they would start eating the basketball for hunger.
No, they usually eat their own legs first.
I see.
So actually, what was going on is that it was a little alienating for me. Obviously, different class stuff. But also, I couldn't speak any Chinese at all. Like, this was, like, very early on to my living situation in Hong Kong. So I had, like, no understanding Chinese. I was so nervous to talk to anyone because my Chinese was so bad that, like, I couldn't really talk. And the coaches were, like, kind of Asian. So I was very used to this Western, oh, let me pat your back when you make a mistake. I'll pick you up when you fall. Hero was more like, get up, what are you fucking doing, you know? And but it was in Chinese, so I didn't know what the fuck they were saying to me.
So you were just getting screamed at by, like, old school Chinese dudes.
Yeah, and everyone that I was with, I couldn't talk to them properly, so, like, I didn't really make friends.
Well, you probably couldn't, like, do, like, the good, like, call outs, like, hey, pass me the rock, because you don't know how to say that in Cantonese.
Actually, a really good example is the first day when they did roll call. I was, like, so nervous when they were calling people's names down and asking them to introduce themselves. One, because I didn't know what to say, but also two, I wasn't even sure I would recognize my own name in Chinese. So, like I said, because I was so bad, I couldn't play near me. My dad was in charge of driving me to the basketball court where I trained. I liked the drives because I would talk to my dad for, like, 45 minutes, and I never saw my dad much when I was young. It also helped that I was young enough to think everything my dad was talking about was, like, factually true, and I thought he was, like, super smart. Plus the fact that you don't really have conversations like these with the people that you're same age. So I felt so mature talking to my dad about all these conversations I thought were deep at that age. Things changed, but back when I was young, I had a lot of fun with my dad. Anyways, there was this one time we, like, started driving back, and then we, like, drove over a rock, I think. I think he spent 2 hours fixing the wheel, and that's, like, the closest I've ever got to, like, getting my car fixed, which was kind of a weird thing because we never did any manual labor. And also, it was just, I don't know, I'm spoiled. So that type of experience was, like, really weird for me.
There is no reason it should take you 2 hours to change a car tire. Not you. I mean, that is, like, the craziest thing I've ever heard.
He didn't know how to do it, I'm pretty sure. I think he was, like, on the phone calling, like, a bunch of people to be like, how do I do this? To be honest, the story might actually be way less interesting in reality, but because of how spoiled I am, it's actually, like, a very big imprint in my life, because I guess I've never seen my family do anything that's, like, manual. So it was, like, kind of exciting. I was like, no. Oh my god, my dad is changing the wheel, look how cool this is.
I fucking hate changing tires, mostly because I don't have the tools for it, because we only have, like, one jack and stuff like that. So I have to be like, hey, mom's tire's flat, can you bring the tools so we can change it? I mean, it's just a little bit of a pain in the ass, and your hands get dirty. But so I had to get my, I could not afford to get my car fixed at a shop. I just, like, don't have that cash right now. My little brother has a close friend whose father is a car guy, and Rocky's a little bit of a car guy, my little brother. So they came over and they got it fixed. My starter was broken.
How did you know your starter was broken, though?
I don't actually know anything about cars, but so I'm like, Dad, the car won't start. What do I do? And he's like, well, first, let's see if the battery's working. And my battery's fine. I know that much because I turn all the lights turned on and everything. And so I was like, okay, well, what the fuck do I do now? And he's like, well, it's turning over, so it's not the ignition switch. You know the thing that when you put the car keys in, it goes like click, click, and goes, that's the ignition switch. But it would go all the way.
That's where you put the money in.
That's where you put the money
for
in.
For the arcade games.
Yes, exactly. That's where I put my quarters in to drive my car. So my quarters are going perfectly fine into my car, but the starter wouldn't start. It would just go click, click. And so my dad goes, go get me a hammer. And I'm like, what? a hammer for a car? Okay. And he's like, okay, well, so sometimes the solenoid, I don't know what the fuck a solenoid is. I'm still not sure what a solenoid is, gets stuck. And so just beat on it with a hammer. And I was like, you just want me to, like, hammer on my car? He's like, yeah. So I'm just like, and it didn't work. So I called my little brother's friend's dad, and he came over. It was like watching an old school war doctor. He, like, just, like, like puts his hand on the car and like puts it in its guts and it's like, turn the thing. And I'm like turning the engine and he's like, yeah, yeah, see, it's not going. And so then I start fixing the car. And when I say I start fixing the car, what I mean is my little brother came and started taking things out of my car while I occasionally pointed at an object in the car and went, you think this boy's the problem? Eventually, they figured out that I needed a new starter, and so they took it all out. I did spend a little bit of money, because if I wanted to, I could have gone online and got a starter for, like, $75, but it would have taken, like, a week to get here, and I just can't be without my car for a week. I have way too much shit to do. I put it back in, and it fucking works like a charm. My AC started working again, too. Rocky doesn't know why that is. He thinks maybe the starter was, like, so bad that it was, like, pulling the electricity.
Maybe the hammer fixed the AC. Hammer.
It was the hammer. You're right. My dad fixed the AC with the hammer. It's double weird because, so yesterday at work, I was like, I'm going to have time to do some things, no stress. And then someone came and used the restroom at the store, and I'm not supposed to let people use the restroom, but I did. Oh, anyone who's listening to this, including my boss, do not tell my boss I did this. Please don't tell my boss, because she would probably be mad. But the fucking sink broke, and I was like freaking out. I was like, I called Rocky. I was like, Rocky, you have to help me fix this shit. Finally, I called my boss and was like, hey, the sink's broken. Me and Rocky figured out what's wrong with it. And by me and Rocky, I mean Rocky. I quietly panicked while Rocky unplugged some, like unscrewed some stuff and figured out what was wrong. And I was right, by the way. Plumber talk, the thing that connected the stopper to the pulley, had gotten snapped because it was so old and rusty. I just didn't know how to get in there and fix it. And Rocky was like, you just need a new part. And I was going to fix it. It was going to take me and Rocky like fucking 10 minutes. But I called my boss and she was like, let the landlord do it. He's supposed to do it. And I guarantee it's not fixed yet because the landlord takes forever. It would have taken me and Rocky like 10 minutes. So I'm like kind of a working man now. I fixed the bathroom recently too. I even fixed a fucking rocking chair, like a wooden rocking chair with like a drill and nails and a hammer. Like, I'm kind of like a man. I'm kind of like a super masculine guy who works out and can fix things with tools now.
Yeah, congratulations.
You're just jealous because you like, what would you
why would you always want me to be jealous of it? Why can't I just be like indifferent and like bored?
Because
of masculinity.
Neither of those are because neither of those are funny for the podcast, Walt. Boredom and apathy aren't funny.
I'm so jealous! Why can't I have big muscles and fix a fucking rocking chair? My God, do I need that skill? Because I see too many rocking chairs in my life that I definitely need fixing every day.
What if you have your favorite rocking chair, it starts breaking? What, you just gonna buy a new
rocking
chair?
First of all, I would never be so fucking stupid to get caught into having a favorite rocking chair.
You don't like rocking chairs?
I have 5 rocking chairs, but I'm not going to have a favorite one.
That's weird, because you have, like, a favorite bowl.
I don't even know where that bowl is. I don't even know what you're talking about, to be honest.
Okay, maybe I'm making it up that you had a favorite bowl.
I do keep possession stuff, so I have mementos for my exes, but if they did break, it wouldn't be that fucking, like, triggering. It'd probably actually be healthy. And my killer whale, which is, like, yeah, it's a real whale, guys, just so you know, like, a real whale.
It's a giant whale. Walter has it in his giant aquarium. It's huge. The reason all of Walter's exes actually got fed to the whale, and so the memento he keeps are just, like, the few bones that the whale didn't eat, just in a jar of formaldehyde.
Yeah, I used to go through so many bedtime stories, my whale would be, like, my fucking ride-and-die killing machine with me.
This is before you killed off your first character and then masturbated, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did I tell that story on the podcast?
Yes, we did. We talked about it in the episode where I talked about toys. One day we got to get Toby on the podcast.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. They always ignore every message when I am too weak and accidentally send something.
Wait, really?
Which I haven't done in a very long time.
Oh, that's wild. When was the last time you sent a message to Toby?
It was definitely in New York.
Okay. So, not that bad, but still bad. I got in contact with my exes. If you're listening, Natrick, what up?
Try getting in contact with the utter rhyme, Haughty.
No, never. I actually thought about that recently because I saw a clip from the show called Shameless, which was their favorite show.
The American one or the UK one?
The American one. And I was like, this looks pretty good.
I just fucking hate people who only watch American versions and not the original version. It's fucking stupid.
Like the original version of SpongeBob?
And Chipotle.
My favorite episode of SpongeBob is where he goes to Chipotle.
Oh my God, these burritos! Oh, fuck, I don't know what I'm trying to.
That was good.
Was that even an impression?
That was a pretty good impression. That was pretty good. His original name was Sponge Guillermo Square Pantalones. It was a Latin American TV show. It was from Paraguay.
Is this true?
No, you stupid, stupid little man. Stupid. Idiot. Can't fix a car. Can't fix a rocking chair. doesn't even know how to do a plumbing. Idiot.
Yeah, but you know what I can do? I can play with dolls. I break down traditional gender norms.
And sometimes
I cry.
Sometimes I cry. But sometimes I cry. Nothing funny about AIDS, actually.
Then why are you laughing, you motherfucker?
Dude, I don't know.
Gross, it's human being.
I'm just like a bad person.
Nah, some people just laugh when things are hard.
The only thing I can think of that's like maybe a little bit funny about AIDS is that episode of South Park. Okay, there's an episode of South Park where Jimmy Buffett is playing like an AIDS benefit, and he just rewrites Cheeseburger in Paradise to be AIDS Burger in Paradise, and it's so stupid. Sometimes I think about that, and I'm like, that was probably in poor taste.
Is there a single episode of South Park that's supposed to be in good taste?
So I, like, think some of the early episodes are, like, kind of okay. Like, I think they, like, push buttons in a way that's appropriate.
Or just early South Park.
Yeah, we're just early. So we watched this movie called Blue from 1993 by this director. He's apparently pretty famous in the art house world, Derek Jarman. I'd never heard of this dude, except for that I realized that one of the movies he directed, The Tempest, I know a little of that because I've always been fascinated with Caliban.
What's Caliban?
Like the monster character from The Tempest. He's like a half man, half beast. Oh, wait,
so you know The Tempest or you know this film in particular?
I know The Tempest and I know a lot of the renditions of it because I'm like, I like Caliban as a character. I think he's like a deeply weird, deeply interesting character. And I think when people do like art house stuff with The Tempest, not just like movies, but also with like theater, especially theater, actually, I don't love plays a whole lot, but I do like The Tempest because of what people do with Caliban. There's like so much that can be done with him, but because he's a monster, it's not like makeup, right? So much of it has to be acting via the body.
Bodies are good.
Let the bodies hit the floor! You know, one more workout thing. That's my number one workout jam, Bodies by Drowning Pool. There's this like leg press machine that I'm trying to be able to press up to 250 pounds. My max right now is like 215. I can do that. I can do 215 pounds, but I want to get to 250. And when I do that, that's like my Let the Bodies Hit the Floor song. Cause I'm like about to lift like a severe amount of weight. Like I feel like my heart's going to explode. And I'm like, let the bodies hit the floor. And I'm like, one, two.
Okay.
Dad, it's such a dick. Just can't even be happy for you. Okay, enough about working out.
I mean, body is always going to be important in this conversation, so it's not going to be the muscle body. It's going to be a little bit more of the dying body.
Yeah, but so this movie is interesting and sort of famous in particular because the director was partially blind during the time the filmmaking was going on, and so he made the entire movie outside of like the dialogue and like the noises that happen. All the visuals are just a single shot of this color of blue, just a blue screen. And the color specifically is International Klein Blue, which for anyone who's interested was first created by a French artist.
Yves Klein.
The hexadecimal code, in case anyone's interested, is pound 002FA7. Is that what that is? That little pound sign? What is that? It's a number sign?
Hashtag, I think.
I mean, they used to be. I mean, that's what they've become because everyone uses it as a hashtag. The number sign, hash, or pound sign. I will be the first to say that this is a pretty fucking weird ass movie because it's just a fucking blue screen.
Yeah, it's definitely experimental. When you were a small boy, was blue your favorite color?
I was never a small boy. I've never been small in my life. I've always been jacked. But when I was a jacked boy, when I was a muscle boy, did I like blue? I was never a kid who was obsessed with color. I actually, a lot of my life, I was in contact, because my little brother was fixated on the color green. So I was always in contrast. I think I probably said my favorite color was blue, but like, I don't really give a shit about blue. I mean, I wear blue jeans.
Wow, your brother had a weird favorite color. Green is not that normal of a favorite color.
He was obsessed with the color green. He would like throw temper tantrums if he didn't get to wear a green shirt.
That explains why he sucks. Joking.
No, he's been helping me out a ton.
Sweet says that on the podcast, but behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes,
Rocky.
I'm like, man, my little brother's such a fucking piece of shit. Nah, he's pulling his weight. He's good.
So I also realized I don't care about colors. I thought blue was my favorite color for the longest of time. But as a kid, when you had to talk about your favorite color, I realized all the guys liked blue. So I wanted to change my favorite color because I was a contrarian and an edgelord even at the age of 7. And I was like, I can't love this color anymore because everyone fucking loves it. I had a guy friend who loved purple, and I thought he was so cool because no one else ever picked that color. But I couldn't figure, I just couldn't. Like, I just couldn't love purple properly. It just was a color that, like, did not make sense to me of being cool.
I'll tell you, my relationship with blue as a child is still the same now. Blue is an incredibly appetizing color to me. If you put two things in front of me, especially if they're desserts, and one is red and one is blue, I will always go to the blue.
Fucking weirdo.
What? Weird? You don't think blue looks yummy?
If I had a tomato soup in front of me and a blue soup in front of me, I'd be like, what the fuck is this goddamn soup?
Please well, okay, go away. That's because there's not a lot of blue soups, Walt. Yeah, like, of course. Oh, yeah, one second. Do you want this brown steak or do you want this green steak? What kind of steak? Yeah,
I had a red fried rice, probably tomato based, maybe ketchup, and a blue fried rice. What is this, blue cheese fried rice?
Okay, but what about
dessert? I don't want that. That's fucking weird.
What about desserts? What about candy? What about desserts and candy? Do you want red?
Candy I can agree to, but red velvet cakes are like one of the better cakes, no?
I don't know, dude. Blue always looks so much more appetizing to me when it comes to desserts and candies.
Tell me what the fuck is a blue cake. What's a blue dessert? What the fuck is a blue dessert?
Blue ice cream? Superman ice cream? Blue ice cream? Cotton candy ice cream?
Is so gross.
What are you talking about? Cotton candy ice cream is like the best little kid flavor.
Oh, but not today, right? Now you've grown up, so you don't like it, right?
Please. No. I'll eat blueberry. My favorite flavor of ice cream is chocolate ice cream. I like a just regular ass chocolate ice cream.
Blueberries are good. I like blueberries.
Blue raspberry Slurpees? Are you kidding me?
Okay, I'm okay with those. I like blue meat.
What, like from a blue, like from a, like a space cow? Like a blue cow?
No, blue meat is like when you like buy like fresh meat and like leave it in your fridge for too long and then you like close your eyes and just cook it because you're too lazy to buy a new meat.
Dude, that's why you and I don't get sick.
Oh, that's why you drink so much NyQuil instead of DayQuil.
Yeah.
NyQuil is blue and DayQuil is red.
Yeah, exactly. It's a blue.
Do you consider blue cheese blue?
Yeah, but I don't like blue cheese. That is one of the few.
I love blue cheese.
It's a little too strong.
I hate weak cheese. It's fucking boring. If you're a weak cheese, pull some weights.
Yeah, that's right. Gotta get your muscle. Yeah.
The cheese is not gonna say something like that. The cheese will be like,
that's the best impression you've ever done on the podcast is your blue cheese impression. It's so good. It's so fucking, it's perfect. No, I like a really sharp cheese. I don't want like a stink cheese, but I want like a sharp cheese.
Oh, you like sharp armpits, not stink armpits.
Yes, that's right. Give me an armpit that's made out of glass and nails. Dude, that I can lick.
Are you attracted to Greek statuettes and their armpits when they do the pose?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I'm like, oh, I wish I could put my wiener on that statue. I wish I could put my wiener on right on midnight on a day old statue right on there. I'm actually not allowed in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
That's what I mean. I want to meet a security guard and see how many times they had to take out a pervert.
The reason he was going blind was because of complications via AIDS. And this movie is about him going blind and about people dying because of complications with AIDS and stuff like that. Maybe we can turn this into a hilarious bit. What do you know about AIDS, Walt?
So, to be quite honest, I never thought of AIDS as anything except a disease. I didn't understand it as a political thing until I came to America. And it was because of the sort of 80s, 90s epidemic. I don't even know. Crisis. That's actually the word.
Yeah, the AIDS crisis. That's what it's called.
That I started learning how it was like a political thing and not just, and why I had a bit of like when I was young, of course, AIDS was like, oh my God, so fucking scary. And I realized after I went to America that fear mongering was very intentional. The funny thing is AIDS in Asia does not have that history, right? But there is AIDS, of course, in China. And I can only speak from my understanding of it. In China, it usually comes from, there was a big AIDS crisis because of blood donation.
It makes a lot of sense to me that you would instantly go political and not talk about the actual nitty gritty of what HIV is. So I'm going to do that real quick.
And if you want to check our sources because you're conscious about fake news or anything, I'll definitely include the links to Suede's sources into our description so you can check that out later.
So HIV is, in fact, a virus. It is a virus that kills your white blood cells and makes it so that you can't fend off infection. Basically, if you get AIDS, your body stops being able to fight off infection. And when it reaches a point where it's like very dangerous, it turns into AIDS. Lots of people, you can have HIV and not have AIDS. And one of the things that makes HIV turn into AIDS is this concept of like HIV reservoirs. One of the reasons it's so hard to get rid of HIV, and in a lot of ways is like quote unquote uncurable, is because the virus will go into these sections of your body and start mass reproducing and won't activate, won't cause you any harm, but will like basically infect you, right? So like your bone marrow, your organs will become infected with the HIV virus, and it makes it almost impossible to get rid of all these viruses. Once these reservoirs are there, you're kind of fucked. You're not fucked, but you're not getting rid of it once the reservoirs are there. And there are lots of people living with AIDS who are totally okay. I know more than a few people. Most of them are dudes who were from the gay community and are undetectable, which basically means because of the medication that you're taking, you can't detect via blood that there's the virus even there. By the way, the easiest way to get AIDS, sex is like a big way, but the way that you get AIDS is through blood transfusion. And that doesn't happen anymore because there is a very quick and easy test that they do to make sure you do not have AIDS before you donate blood. But your chances of getting AIDS via sex is like high, but not like 1,000,000% high. If you get blood from a person with AIDS or with HIV, there's a high likelihood you're going to contact it, which is why it's so important that they, you know, that people test. And there, during the AIDS crisis at the beginning, a lot of blood donation people were like not interested in screening for AIDS because they were sure it was going to be really expensive. And so there was a lot of AIDS because of that. And there's another thing that's probably worth mentioning is one of the reasons why AIDS is so rampant in the gay community is because it's actually way more likely to get AIDS via anal sex than it is through vaginal sex or oral sex or something like that. Because of the makeup of the anus, right? Because of like the mucus carries AIDS way more. The anal cavity holds more of the virus. And the anal cavity is also like more delicate, right? So it's easier to perforate and rip and make it bleed a little bit, which again is another way you can contact HIV. It's not just men having sex with a male anus or whatever. Like anyone who has an anus and has anal sex has a higher likelihood of transmitting AIDS. It doesn't matter what gender you are or what you identify as or whatever.
But in America, it was mostly a education thing, right?
What do you mean?
Like a lot of the reason why it ended up being a disease that inflicted the gay community is because of the government just did not produce the right information properly.
Oh yeah, no, that's totally part of it. Ronald Reagan didn't say AIDS until well within the AIDS. Like he did not utter the words AIDS or HIV until like really, really, really deep within, you know, the AIDS crisis. People called it gay cancer in the beginning. That was a community that people didn't want to interact with. And so of course, you know, there's just not a lot of education. You're right that the lack of education and the unwillingness to talk about AIDS protection or like how to keep yourself safe had to do with the fact that no one cared and in a lot of ways thought the gay community deserved what they got. Nowadays, you go on a dating app, like Grindr, for instance, they have a little section to say whether or not you have HIV. I saw a lot of dudes on there, not a lot, but a few dudes who are like, I have HIV, but I am undetectable, which if you're undetectable, there's a good chance you can, you're not going to get AIDS if you have sex with that person. That's not 100% true, of course, and you want to be careful whenever you have sex with anyone and wear a condom and stuff like that. Say something funny, Walt. Say something funny about AIDS.
To be quite honest, though, this is what I actually will respond with. Like, when you first told me that you were going to go and do a lot of research on this stuff so that our podcast wouldn't just look like fools talking about foolish things, I do think it's pretty ironic with everything you said, Suede, because I kind of feel Jarman's Blue is actually really focused on creating distance between the narrative that you've just given or like the discussion about the science of AIDS even. And not distance because he thinks that narrative is bad, but Blue is just something way more personal. And I don't think Jarman would be like, why are you guys fucking talking about my movie and doing such a scientific sort of political talk about it?
No.
But I do think a big part thematically of his movie was this sort of distancing from the narrative of AIDS.
Well, I think the reason, part of the reason I wanted to have sort of a conversation about what AIDS is because I was actually talking to a friend recently. She was like so surprised at the lack of our generation's knowledge of like Zoomers and Millennials, like just like missing gaps of information. And one of those is about the AIDS crisis, right? And like, I have a feeling if I went downstairs right now and asked my little brother about AIDS, he wouldn't know a whole lot about it, right? And I think it's because there's this narrative in our year 2022 that we've like beaten AIDS. And that's like not even close to the truth.
And it's not just about beating AIDS, too, because for me, the crisis is so historical and so traumatic in a event way.
Yeah.
It's so ingrained in an identity of American culture that it blows my mind that it's not talked about more. Not talking about the AIDS crisis is literally stripping a huge part of American identity away from America. About the Jarman thing that I was about to say, Jarman actually tries to distance himself from the narratives. The big quote. Let's start it like this. Instead of just diving into the quotes, because this movie is just a blue screen, the audio is very important.
The audio is the most important.
The music is fucking amazing. There's like prog rock into industrial acapella into like new wave music all at once. And the sound engineering is like so fucking incredible.
It's fantastic.
And then there's like these chorus chantings. One of the famous ones I think is like, I am not a gay.
Wait, one second. Shut your mouth. The quote is, I am not gay. I am a mannish muff-diving size queen with a bad attitude, an arse-licking psychofag, molesting the flies of privacy, bawling lesbian boys, a perverted hetero demon, crossing purpose with death. I am a cocksucking, straight-acting lesbian man. And then the chorus, he is a cocksucking, straight-acting lesbian man. And this is just one section. One of the really fantastic things about this movie, right, is the dialogue. Because it goes from that, it's very in-your-face, kind of like modern punk rock style gay stuff, to there's all this incredible like fantasy lines. The road to the city of Aquavita is protected by a labyrinth, built from crystals and mirrors, which in the sunlight cause terrible blindness. The mirrors reflect each of your betrayals, magnifying them, and drive you into madness. Blue walks into the labyrinth. Absolute silence is demanded to all its visitors, so their presence does not disturb the poets who are directing excavation. I mean, like, there's, like, all this, like, really incredible, crazy, like, metaphor language. Listen to this. Blue fights diseased yellow belly, whose fetid breath scorches the trees with yellow algae. Betrayal is in the oxygen of his devilry. He'll stab you in the back. Yellowbelly placed a jaundiced kiss in the air. The stink of pus blinds Blue's eyes. Evil swims in the yellow bile. Yellowbelly's snake eye poison. He crawls over Eve's rotting apple, wasp-like. Quick as a flash, he stings Blue in the mouth, his hellish legion buzzing, and a chuckle in the mustard gas. I mean, it's just like so fucking sharp, nicotine-stained fangs bared. It's like Conan-style fantasy shit. Only this dude is like just talking about how brutal it is to be dying of AIDS.
I think the fanny sections are like very important in showing the world that Jarman is like trying to defend against. Because I think for Jarman, it was very important for him to make a movie that rejected, he actually called it appropriation of the story of what AIDS is. There's this line where computer sounds into like him declaratively saying, I shall not win the battle against a virus in spite of slogans like living with AIDS. The virus was appropriated by the world, so we have to live with AIDS while they spread the quotes from the moss of Ithaca across the lying dark sea. Awareness is heightened by this. Something else is lost. A reality drowned in theater. Thinking blind, becoming blind. So our awareness of AIDS and the way we talk about AIDS and even like our conversation just now, even though you had to do the conversation first, it does forget or lose the death or the dying or the illness itself. And this is why this film does so much weird shit, if you want to call it that, because it's fundamentally so important in distancing itself from that main narrative of how history wants to talk about HIV.
I think that line you bring up in particular is like really important because it kind of is a cross section of everything that this movie can present. It has something really ugly and unflinching, which is like the reality of the end of a life because of complications via AIDS. It's also got this like intense fantasy stuff, right? So you've got the moths of Ithaca referencing like Greek mythology and stuff like that, but also referencing modern day the AIDS quilt. You know about the AIDS quilt, right, Walt?
I fucking have no idea what it means.
So Ithaca, of course, is the setting of one of the most famous myths of ancient Greek, the Odyssey, right? Where the main hero, Odysseus, he lives in Ithaca and is the rightful ruler. So you have classical references. You also have the AIDS quilt, which was basically this like giant quilt that people made that was like each square was a person who died of AIDS. Like it's huge. It like covers a football field. They're mythologizing an experience, right? I mean, that's what he's so angry about, is this incredibly visceral personal experience has been mythologized.
And they act almost like as a cover. Ends up being a cover for the lying dark sea of what he's saying.
And I will be honest, I did not have a good time watching this movie. I thought it was deeply upsetting. I almost quit watching it 40 minutes in. I powered through it. And it's because of how brutal the descriptions of dying from AIDS-related complications. The suffering from AIDS is rendered in such an honest way, right? Nowadays, when we talk about AIDS, we don't talk about people suffering from it. People living with AIDS, all the great things that are happening, people are surviving, it's strength. And it ignores this, like, really ugly element, which is that, like, also it really sucks. I mean, this, especially in the beginning, there was no living with AIDS. There was just dying with AIDS. I mean, this shit killed you quick. The two dominant narratives now are, like, memorializing these people who've passed away, or being like, look at these people surviving, right? And what this movie articulates is the suffering that no one wants to look at. You know, it's a little bit like Gummo, where there's no mythology in the suffering. There's mythology in talking about AIDS when Jarman, like, uses his fantasy language, but there's not a mythology when he's, like, talking about the medication that he has to take. There's a section where he lists down all the complications that could come from the medication he's using to try and stop his blindness. And it's literally like a 5-minute list.
Also, the other reason why there's no mythology is because the narrative is so weak. Well, it's not weak. That's the wrong word. It's hard to mythologize something or romanticize something unless you sell a story.
Yeah, there
and
is no narrative.
Because this film's lack of story, it breaks even the concept of mythologizing it completely. Because you're just getting like moments of
vignettes.
Okay, yeah.
It's almost like a collection of short stories. I will say, for anyone who's interested, I would read the script. I mean, the movie's really great. Watch the movie afterwards. Print out the script and read it, because it is so fantastic.
You can listen to this movie by an album, too, these days.
There's something unpalatable for a lot of people about the ugliness of pain and death. When you watch cancer movies, it's always like either the valiant struggle or like the brutality of it. But this, there's an anger. I think that's really what there's an anger and a frustration and a helplessness that is like presented through the dialogue that makes it like really hard to watch, because this is not someone who's like playing a character. This isn't like Hugh Laurie in House pretending to have cancer. No, this dude is like dying and he knows it. And he's talking about it right now.
But there's also an agency and a release. It's not always there. But like, that's why the movie flips around so much into different things, because his poem about the character of Blue, who is like transcending or whatever, what Blue is doing, it's not hopeful, but it's definitely not completely the negative emotions that you just mentioned. I do think the anger is important, but I think it's important to also notice the sort of, I don't think hope is the right word. But
I don't think there's any hope in this movie. I don't think there's any hope in this movie. I think the closest we get,
there's release.
I think that the closest we get is the catharsis that comes from being able to present your pain. I don't think there's any hope.
But even at the end, he says about like laying some flowers on his gravestone. I don't see that as like an angry lay of flowers.
No, there is some acceptance. There is some acceptance. I don't think that's happy acceptance. I don't think it's a positive. I think it is the acceptance of the dying. I don't think it's anything else other than that.
Okay, then maybe what our difference opinion is here is that I don't think anger or I do think the film is very negative and sad. Okay, fine.
Say what you're gonna say. Say it.
I don't have anything to say. Oh, maybe it's like this. To reduce it to like it's only fucking nihilism is not the point at all either.
That is true. It's not nihilism, because there is acceptance and there is an attempt at control. There is an agency. That's why it's not nihilism. I think nihilism is a lack of agency in a lot of ways. The agency and the choice is in acceptance and description, not in actual control. Which I think when you interact with people who are in terminal spaces, that's like the thing that is the easiest to present in a fake way and the hardest to actually look at. Because we've all seen movies where like the mom who's dying of cancer is like, I'm just gonna go, it's okay, it's gonna be painless, baby. And the guy's like, no, mom! And then she dies, and then he goes and hangs out with a space raccoon.
What Jarman definitely doesn't try to put in too much is like fear. The type of emotions you usually think about with death, he definitely takes fear out of this film in a very deliberate way.
Well, no, that's exactly it, Walt. That's the brutal part of the acceptance, is that people think that when you accept it, it's like good. But like, you're like, oh, I'm free. He even says, everyone thinks morphine gets rid of pain. Instead, it quantifies it. And I think the acceptance is like that. There's not a whole lot of fear, but there is still pain and ugliness and hurt. Even without the fear, the acceptance isn't peaceful. You can be at peace, but it's not a peaceful acceptance.
Which is why he gets angry in this film, and why this film is so non-narrative, and because it's confusing, it's messy.
I wouldn't say it's confusing or messy.
I think there's a bit of deliberate messiness in it. Because
I don't think messy is the right term, then.
Okay, this is the word I would prefer to use than delirious. And I think of it as, like, the film itself is trying to be similar to the way the virus is acting towards Jarman. AIDS makes Jarman delirious, which is why the film embodies delirium. It changes Jarman's reality, which is why the reality of the film is a little different than usual. And the most obvious example is it makes him blind, so that's why the movie is all blue.
No, that's a perfect word. There's a fever dream element to this, right? Because the feverishness of these fantasy segments, even the fantasy segments are non-linear. They're non-narrative. Descriptions are made in a linear context, right? Like, it's not just word vomit. The sentences have a linear structure. They do not present an actual narrative. It's much closer to a fever dream. So I think delirium, and that's why
Dolores.
Oh, Don't fire me! No, I think that's why I would call this movie kind of a razor wire. I mean, everything feels so controlled. Can I reevaluate what I mean, positive versus negative?
Sure. I don't think it matters if it's below zero or above zero.
If it's a 0-100 kettle pot. No, I'm talking about, there are not a lot of emotions that are pleasant in this film. This is not a movie that, like, is gonna coddle you. This is not a comfortable film. This is like a scream. This is a yell of pain. This is not a movie that you're going to come away from and be like, man, that sure was beautiful. You're like, I mean, it was beautiful, but it's also like, it's a confrontational film. I think this film is a confrontation. I think this is a middle finger in a lot of ways to the world.
I like that. No wonder when I watched this movie, I shied away because I'm not a confrontational. Dude, actually, so many fucking people today in this world love to talk about how I'm not a confrontational person. It would be so fun to just like throw this movie at those people's faces and be like, sit here, learn to be confrontational.
Watch it. That, I will say, that is one of my biggest frustrations, is people are only confrontational in certain contexts and never confrontational when they need to be. And so then when there are the people who are being confrontational and are like doing it for a good reason, they get labeled as like mean. Like at the best, they're like mean and aggressive, and at the worst, they're domestic terrorists, right? And it's like, no, we all need to be being more confrontational. So like, if you have a friend who gets mad at you for doing something shitty and is confrontational about it, don't get all butt hurt, because they're doing the right thing. The only thing that you've done wrong, outside of maybe the shitty thing you did, is you also need to be confrontational.
I mean, we all could improve, because you just make jokes to confrontational people and then make them more angry.
That's right. This is 2022, the year of confrontation.
That's why this podcast is making a stance. Teabagging is okay in video games.
Teabagging,
it is not sexual assault.
In video games is okay. Drinking tea from a bag is okay.
Jarman was English. I wonder if he liked tea.
Dude probably loved tea. Let's talk about tea. What's your favorite tea?
Fuck. I'm actually like the least Asian tea person. No, I like a Hong Kong milk tea. The bubble tea, but like fucking bubble tea in America is like fucking shit tier, fucking whatever the fuck that fucking... I'm going to be confrontational again.
All right, let's be confrontational.
Fuck American bubble tea.
That's right.
It fucking blows. I don't know what the fuck that shit is.
What are they doing? No, hit him again.
You Americans, stick to your diet soda.
That's right.
Get out of my bubble tea.
Get out of bubble tea, you weak little goblins. And you know what, while we're at it? Fuck Asian people, right, Walt?
No, I hate Asian people disappoint me. That's all I'll say.
No, we love our Asian
Do you like tea or coffee, Sweet?
I need a cup of coffee in the morning because I am Garfield.
Do you also eat spaghetti?
Now it's time for me to be confrontational. Garfield likes lasagna, you dumbass. You stupid fucking. Oh my god.
This is a cultural thing because all Americans, the pasta stuff is like so different for them. Like they think lasagna and fucking whatever is so fucking different.
No, this is a Garfield thing. Stop making this a national thing or a race thing.
No, but this I'm telling you, I bring white people to Asia. I will bring them like 3 different noodle places, and all the time white people will be like, after like 3 or 4 of them, they'll be like, yo, can we stop eating noodles? And I'll be like, what do you mean? They're fucking different.
You're deflecting. You're deflecting right now. All right,
I apologize to fucking lasagna. You want me to apologize to Garfield or fucking lasagna?
I don't give a shit about lasagna, but Garfield doesn't eat spaghetti. He doesn't eat ratatouille. He doesn't eat gumbo.
Ratatouille
jelly noodles
and gumbo are so fucking different from pasta.
I know, but what I'm saying is Garfield eats lasagna. That's his whole thing. It's integral to his core. This would be like if I read Aria and I was like, oh yeah, my favorite part of Aria is where they like ride around in motorcycles. Garfield eats lasagna.
That's like not even remotely close.
Yes, it is.
If you rode a motorcycle in the canals of Mars, your motorcycle would like fall into the water and stop.
They're not in water. They're on the road. It's fine. It's the same thing. That's what you sound like. That's what you sound like when you say spaghetti is the same as lasagna within the context of Garfield.
Spaghetti and lasagna are fucking the same thing.
I'm gonna kiss you on the mouth. I'm gonna kiss you.
Cars and canoes are
They're
not
called
the fucking
gondolas,
same.
Not canoes, you dumbass.
Mac and cheese. That's what Garfield eats.
I mean, Garfield would eat all of these things. His favorite is lasagna, though. And it was because he was born in an Italian restaurant. You stupid bastard.
Do Italians even eat lasagna?
I don't know, but Jim Davis thinks they do. I drink coffee in the morning to stay alive. If I'm sick, I will drink tea. But I don't really like tea because it's hot. I don't really like a hot beverage unless it's coffee. I'll drink a tea if someone makes a cup for me, like a cup of the good stuff. But I'm not a big tea person. I do like a ginger tea, especially if my stomach's upset. Or a throat coat. There's this stuff we get called throat coat. It's like tea that's good for a sore throat.
All the teas I drink are cold like juice. Like lemon tea, milk tea.
Does it have a lot of sugar in it?
It's like southern sweet tea.
Okay,
You're not fucking drinking tea.
Yeah,
dude.
No, southern sweet tea does not count as tea. It's good. I mean, I guess. I don't like sweet tea. Yeah.
I like summer tea. It's pretty fucking fun.
No, if I had my favorite tea is probably chamomile tea.
Yeah, I don't like any of those herb teas. It's fucking the ones that, oh my god, you drink this, all the girls will smell your hormones and then you'll fucking like lose a dick. Fuck
no,
off.
It's good. Some teas like the throat coat always makes my throat feel
this
better.
Drink this and then you'll sleep better. Fuck you. I'm just gonna sleep better because I know how to sleep
better.
Dude,
that's crazy because you believe in Chinese medicine, which is literally just herbs without them being boiled. I mean, there's literally like herbal medicine tea.
When have I ever drank Chinese medicine in front of you?
Every day. Every day you get up. You open up your jar.
I don't.
Yes, you do. Don't lie.
You got defeated and you're like fucking making
stories
up.
I wish you guys could
see
this. In the back of Walter's wall, just all these bottles and jars filled with like snake heads, oils, and jars, and he in the morning he puts them all in a jar and he drinks it and he says it makes me strong.
That's the dumbest thing ever, because anyone who knows me knows that I don't have anything in my house.
That's true. Your house is just a computer and like jizz tissues.
Since we're already politicizing fucking we're quoting this movie right now with our politics and shit, let's do it a little more. Do you remember the great theorist, philosophy professor, philosophy student, philosophy connoisseur, philosophy genius, Tory Lavander?
I remember Tory Lavander. I remember him well. He's one of our closest friends and also the least funniest member of the podcast.
But that's because his brain is using so much energy for his genius philosophy
takes. That's true. He's just such a philosophy genius. It did take him an extra year to get into grad school, but...
That's just because he wanted to go to a good grad school program, dude. Do you remember his genius idea about necropolitics?
That's from Foucault, right? Isn't necropolitics Foucault?
Technically, biopower is from Foucault, and then necropolitics is sort of an extension of biopower, and necropolitics is probably coined by, fuck, time to be a little bit racist because I can't pronounce his name, Akil Mbembe?
Oh, it should, if it's on Wikipedia, it should say how to pronounce it.
I can't read that gibberish, man.
Oh,
that gibberish,
oh, is gibberish,
it's
gibberish now, fucking racist.
I hate the fucking pronunciation, goddamn fucking whatever that garbage ass upside down E means. Why do you need an upside down E to make me understand and pronounce something?
Oh,
it fucking makes no sense.
Oh my god. So biopolitics is thinking about our bodies in a political context, right? Like making AIDS not a scientific thing but a political thing. That's biopolitics.
I almost want to say yes because I'm too lazy to like understand it too.
No, you need to define you need to define biopolitics for the fucking podcast. You're the one who got a philosophy degree. Fucking explain it.
Okay, let me fucking see.
What? Doesn't even know how to define biopolitics. You got a fucking philosophy major. Idiot. Stupid.
I don't actually think I did much on fucking Foucault.
You didn't do anything. You want to know what you did in college? You played your waifu game and got drunk and occasionally wrote an essay at the last minute. You graduated with like a 2.0 GPA.
That's not true at all. My GPA was fucking fine, dude.
Wasn't as fine as me and Tori.
I think for Foucault, there was like a time period in history where he saw a huge increase in how states regulated their subjects' bodies with power.
A good example of biopower now is the, you know, fight for reproductive rights.
Yes.
You know, that is
yes.
an inherently biopolitical conversation, right? It's a lot of other things too. It's a feminist conversation, it's an intersectional conversation, it's a capitalist conversation, but it is also an incredibly biopolitical conversation or a conversation on biopower. And I think necropolitics is similar. When I think of necropolitics, I think of how you can't lay down a body that's dead wherever you want. You have to tell the government it's been buried. You have to, like, acknowledge that person's death. This is, like, an example of necropolitics. Even our death is controlled by the bureaucracy of the United States government. I mean, this is if you're in the United States, I'm sure. I Walter says we have international listeners. And we do, so it's probably similar to lots all over the world. You laugh? Well, you think that's funny? You think that's funny, you little cheeky boy?
Do you understand how American-centric and offensive what you just said is to our international listeners? Maybe you Americans are the international ones.
Wow, how could you say that? No, but like, it's not just because like, oh yeah, the government needs to know who's dead. It's like, death is inherently linked with taxes and, what is it called when you give someone something when you die? Hereditary stuff.
Necrophilia.
Yeah, necrophilia. Kissing a horse on the mouth.
Kissing a horse because horses are dead things. All horses are dead.
Digging up your grandma's bones, selling them to a wizard.
That's true. That's true. Using people's bookbinding business to create zombies.
That's true. Taking a person's face flesh and turning it into a mask that you can wear for when you want to scare your neighbors.
More radically, we're talking about like revolutions. Two, giving up your life to kill things.
Well, like the act of a suicide bomber is an inherently necropolitical action. It's not just a political action. It is a necropolitical action.
I think your examples are related to necropolitics, but I'm not exactly sure if they're the focus, if that's how I should put it. To me, I see necropolitics more about how people should die, so it's still more about living people. In fact, Mbembe actually uses the term living dead to define his coining of necropolitics. Let's say like Black Lives Matter, technically you can get through life without dying as a black life. That potentiality of death keeps you in check as almost a sort of dead statistic, or you're at least always in relationship to that statistic politically, which makes your life not entirely alive politically.
Okay, here's one thing I have to ask. You said that there are some people who can make it through life without death. Are you talking about people who can live forever? What the fuck are you talking about? Like, who gets to live forever?
Yes. Once in a while. You know the BFG and how, like, he had, like... Can we talk about Roald Dahl? He's pretty bad, right? He's a bad person.
I'm pretty sure he wasn't a big fan of the Jews, but, like, it is what it is. I'm Jewish.
Okay. So, Roald Dahl, BFG, there was, like, another who liked to stand on top of the state empire entire building in New York and like pluck people to eat. Yes. That's what God does. That's why only people in New York live forever. That's Everywhere true. Else in the world is
That's
doomed.
True. You actually can't die of old age in New York. You can only die from like an accident or a crime or something like that.
Yeah, that's why the Rockefellers, Warren Buffett, they all live in New York. Mm-hmm. They're using their money. They're trying to get plucked up from God to live forever. God's kind of a racist. And he's also kind of homophobic.
That's true.
And he's also classist.
Maybe the Christian God, not our God we invented. Remember our God who speaks in like scrabbly, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that one. Gargar, Gargar, my favorite.
Yeah.
So to answer your question seriously, I think the argument for this use of term is that politically in general, there are some vibes that tend to be talked about in a relationship to death compared to the normal life. There are lies in our society that you can't even think about without already thinking about their death. So like obviously queer lives, the statistics of queer life is not good. I don't know why I laughed.
No. Well, because it's like so hard to what's the statistic that like 40% of trans people are going to end up killing themselves? Like something super brutal like that. I call that laughing into the void. You're like so uncomfortable because it's like such a brutal truth that you like start to laugh because like what else do you do? Queer existence, you know, like there's a lot of ways to die. But I mean, back during the AIDS crisis, oh man.
Yeah. Jarman even references this. He goes through a bunch of names of people he knows and then mentions how they died. In some ways, this film is a very fucking great example of working in necropolitics. Now I think about it, I think the reason why I wanted to, in the end, differentiate what I view as the main focus of necropolitics and everything you said is because that's really important for Blue. Jarman isn't dead yet. He is dying, but he's still an alive agent. He's not making a film about the dead. He's making a film about life, even if that life is dying. Blue decisively uses life politically. To treat this film seriously, you can't view this film about a corpse, which is what the main narrative of AIDS or traumatic events usually are about. Once they are in the past, they are already about the dead, which puts this film in a very unique sort of circumstance. If I could make a list of necropolitical films, this would 100% like a top.
Name another one. Literally name another one. Necromantic.
Okay, Necromantic. Yeah, the great German deep art house movie about serious stuff where it's not about a girl who just digs up her boyfriend's corpse to fuck. Yeah, that film.
Dumplings is a necropolitical film.
I mean, it's not a terrible example too, because in so many ways, necropolitics, because it involves death and corpses, a lot of people do it by like making horror films or like dark films or something like this. This film, as you said, is like so not like that. There's not much fear. The anger and confrontation is very strong. This is why I don't want, even though it deals with so many things that could easily make it into almost a dark kind of movie, it's not dark in that type of way.
It's not dark in a sad way, and it's not dark in a scary way. It's dark in a confrontational way. It's a brooding film. Are you afraid of dying?
I actually, weirdly enough, my fear levels have increased a lot in the past week for some reason.
Oh, really?
But then it like sort of disappears again. Yeah, I don't know what I was doing. Maybe I was watching a movie or something. I don't know. Sometimes something triggers something and then I just like think about it a lot. And I'm like really scared.
I used to be terrified of death as a small child. That was actually the first time I started going to therapy. Guys, I was going to a child psychologist. And part of it was I was so terrified of dying. And as an adult now, I mean, I have like the animal responses to fear. You know, when like a car swerves out in front of me, like I'm like, oh my God. And because my body's like trying to make me stay alive. But I don't really fear death of myself anymore. I'm not afraid of the end. I think the process is pretty scary, but like not existing doesn't seem all that terrible. I'm much more afraid of people I love dying.
I get scared of the process.
Yeah, that's the scary part.
If it's a painful death, I freak out a lot about that stuff too. Oh, you know what I fucking... You know what it was? Okay, it was fucking that stupid fucking movie, the samurai movie. What was it called again? Fucking Demons. The samurai guy tries to like poison them and it looks so painful in the film. So I Google suicide by poisoning, because there was other types of suicide that was going on in that movie, and people were describing how it was like to die from poison, and I was like,
no, it sucks. Oh my, it sucks.
God. And it like freaked me out a little. I was like, oh. Which is kind of like these diseases. It's so prolonged in a way that your body feels physically ill, in the same way that that's what AIDS would be doing, or like cancer.
What do you think would be the best way to die?
Heart attack from coming. I actually don't know if that's true at all, because that'd probably be very painful.
See, I've always wanted to die, like, for someone. Like, I think it'd be so sweet to be like, oh no, the Dark Lord has arisen, and there's, like, a warrior with, like, an axe, and here I am, like, a grizzled old man with nothing but, like, my hammer that I use at my forge, and, like, a shield that my grandson gave to me so long ago, and I'm like, get to the boat, family! And I, like, put my shield out in front of me, and I'm like, come at me, you bastard! Even though I know I'm getting ready to die, I, like, save my family. So that would be a pretty cool way to die. That's how I want to die, is, like, force another someone. Or, like, if, like, there was, like, a guy who was trying to get you, and I, like, jumped in front.
Yeah,
and, like,
don't do it for me. It will be wasted on me.
It would not be wasted for me. I love you! I want it to be, like who
would,
like... Yeah,
but I wouldn't accept it in the same way that your family would probably do it. Your family would probably be like, let's fucking love Suede for doing it, and I'd probably be like, I feel really bummed down and sad, but I also know if I gave him the attention in his death, he'd feel really happy, so I'm not gonna give it to him.
There's a Naruto character that does that, isn't there, who like stands in the way of an attack and like accepts death. Fucking Zabuza does that. Zabuza, the demon swordsman of the mist, he saves Haku at the end, remember?
Oh, I don't fucking remember that shit.
Well, you're a stupid bastard and I hate you.
I don't know Naruto as well as you, fuck. Don't they all die and do it? Like, fucking even Itachi and fucking Jiraiya and fucking Azusa?
Azusa doesn't, Jiraiya doesn't, and Itachi, I think, kills himself via one of Sasuke's attacks on purpose.
Oh, you mean, like, standing in front of a large crowd and being like, I'm so sacrificing myself.
Or not even a large, like, you know, like someone's about to, like, run, like, you know, like,
no,
someone's,
I guess, like, what running. You want to do, I'm talking about, like, Naruto. Like, I thought Jiraiya and Azusa both, like, die knowing.
They do die knowing, but they didn't sacrifice themselves. That's what I want to do. I want to sacrifice myself for someone else.
Oh, well, I didn't realize they didn't sacrifice themselves.
I mean, it's been a million years since I read it.
I think the issue, though, is that the reason why I have to relearn how to be scared of death and then get over it, though, I get the feeling it's because I'm too much of an alcoholic. So the longest of time I thought I wasn't scared of death was because I was trying to drink myself to death because I hated myself so much. Now, because I still drink, but, like, I'm trying to be a fucking human. It's, like, relearning. Oh, yeah, there is stuff that I want to live for. So maybe wanting to drink myself to death is not exactly what I want to do anymore. So that's, like, a difference.
That's actually really interesting, because for me, I stopped being afraid of death once I was in a really dark place in my life. Once I got out of that dark place, I was like, man, that sucked. That's probably going to happen again. Oh, but it won't happen again one day when I'm not alive. And I was like, okay, cool, cool, cool. Well, I guess death is okay with me now, because it means I don't have to suffer.
But me getting out of my dark place had a lot to do with me getting over a desire to drink myself to death.
Well, I'm glad you're alive, Walter.
I just wish I did way more harder drugs so I could be a true recovery addict. Actually, that's probably really insensitive to all our addict friends. That's irresponsible.
Hey, we're all addicted to something.
That's like, we're all from Africa.
We are all technically from Africa. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's how evolution works, but...
Let's talk about the fucking Blue.
Little boy Blue. Little boy Blue, come blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow. The cow's in the corn.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You don't know that poem? Little boy Blue, come blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow.
The only fucking poem I fucking know is this poem. Blue by Derek Jarman. Is Twinkle Twinkle Little Stars a poem?
Yes. But what about the one about how you look outside your window and you see the moon and it reminds you to love
China?
Okay,
that's not a poem to me. That's a spice.
It's a spice. It's not a poem. It's a spice. No, it's an old nursery rhyme.
I've never heard of it.
Little boy,
Humpty Dumpty sat on a
wall. Yeah, it's one of those. Little boy Blue, come blow your horn. The sheep's in the meadow, the cow's in the corn. But where is the boy who looks after the sheep? He's under a haystack fast asleep. It's like Twinkle Twinkle Little Star.
So is this boy blue?
His name's Little Boy Blue. I mean, dude, it's a fucking nursery rhyme. What do you want me
to... You quoted it! Maybe you have, like, a very deep connection to it. I don't know.
I mean, I don't know any more than... Like, wait. Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And you'd look at me and be like, why is he an egg? And I'm like, I don't know why he's an egg. It's because it's important for the rhyme.
I know why he's an egg.
Why is he an egg?
Because he needed to crack and then not spill the yolk, so it gave it that sort of mythology.
But so that's, he's blue because it rhymes. Little boy blue, come blow your horn. Well, it doesn't really rhyme. I don't know why he's blue. You're right. I have no clue. I have no fucking clue. Quick test. What color was this blue?
The Yvonne's Laurent Nordle France Le Front.
It's international Klein blue. International. Je ne sais pas. C'est bon. My dad speaks a little Cajun French because he's a fucking Cajun swamp man. And he would always look at the cat and go, c'est bon? C'est bon, Miss Biggs? C'est bon? And just, is it good? C'est bon, Minou?
I love that story.
I'm glad.
Wow.
I love you and I love your mom. Can you just quick love your mom for me, Walt? Can you say that you love your mom?
Yeah, I love my mom. All the bits are coming back today.
It's
because
back.
This podcast is so fucking serious. We have no idea how to make it funny. Yeah. So the only way we're just like, oh, what's funny beforehand? Let's bring it back.
Yep, exactly.
I like what you said. It does make me a little curious about something we first mentioned at the start of the podcast. So why do you think like so many fucking kids like blue?
It's because blue is for boys and pink is for girls. That's like the thing that people say, right?
The thing is, like, okay, pink, you put on your Barbies, you put on your dolls, blah blah blah, you put on your unicorns. You don't put blue on He-Man.
No. I mean, red is traditionally the most masculine color in the narrative, but I think red is like a little too abrasive to put on a baby, right? Like red is a combative color.
That's why I understand in theory why this film uses blue as a confrontational color, but in the back of my head...
No, the reason it's blue is because it's the only color he can see, you dumbass.
Yes, okay. I understand that. I just mean that, like, in the back of my head, there's, like, this little thing that goes, this is kind of ironic because blue is so normie.
What's the best color?
Now?
Yeah.
Now that we both don't care about colors?
Yeah, what's the best color?
I still think it's black for me. I like black. You want to try to make a race joke or something?
No, I would never do that. My favorite color, I mean, the color I wear the most is black.
The issue is I have colors that I like, but I don't want to use them. I actually today really like pink because all my favorite anime waifus have pink hair. But if someone was like, do you want to wear a pink shirt?
Bad take, stupid idiot. Pink-haired waifus are bad.
Akari?
Akari's not a waifu, Walt. You said she's a goddess.
Okay, so all my anime goddesses have pink hair. Well, I also have admitted on this podcast I think Sakura is fine. So.
which is a crazy take. Mimimi from Fooly Cooly is very good, though, and she has pink hair, so.
There are some annoying ones, like Mira Nikki's girl fucking blows.
Yeah, she does.
Get her out of my life.
It is pretty cool when she uses her axe to cut people up, though. I do like that part.
Oh, Yadere, cut me up. Oh.
No, I just like, I love the axe as a weapon. Like, it's just like so brutal because there's no finesse with an axe. It's like such a good, scary criminal weapon. A sword, you know, there's like artistry to it, or like a flail, you're spinning it. But an axe is literally just a hammer that cuts.
Oh, well, the artistry is the lumberjack. You know,
yeah, but that's not artistry. That's masculinity, Walt, which we love on this podcast.
Okay, you haven't fucking let me finish to understand why it's artistry. Imagine the lumberjack takes his axe and hits a log and he does it again over and over and over again until it's night. He goes to bed. He wakes up. He does it again. Goes to bed. Wakes up. He does it again until the day he dies. The end. That's like the old man in the sea, those type of stories, dude.
No, that is literally masculinity. Fucking the old man in the sea is like a masculine treatise. It's not good, but it's about masculinity.
You don't like the old man in the sea?
Nah, I think it's boring. It's fine. It's well written. I mean, it's good. I don't love Hemingway's prose.
Okay, you just fucking said it's not good.
So it's not my thing. I think Hemingway's prose are pretty like short and curt and to the point. I don't know. I just think there are people who do it better. Like, I think Cormac McCarthy does what Hemingway does, only does it a whole hell of a lot better. I think Hemingway also like puts masculinity on a pedestal, and Cormac McCarthy like really
Cormac disillusioned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, we've probably talked about this on the podcast.
Whoa, someone better write a paper.
Yeah, someone. Not me. I'm too busy writing about wizards. Someone else can have that.
The genius of Swayed Tori.
Yeah, here with these. I got a 4.0 GPA. Walter's got a 2.0 GPA.
I probably could get into grad school faster than you could.
Yeah, that's because you have $1 million, you bastard. Look at me over here scribbling
that
and scrabbling.
That means I'm smarter.
No, it doesn't. Generational wealth does not include intellect. You're the dumbest motherfucker I ever met, you fucking little bastard.
Okay, check out society. Check out society.
Oh, we live in society? Oh.
No, I don't mean we live in it. I'm saying just check it and like look at what makes people smart. It's money.
Oh, so rich people are smart. People who are rich and have a lot of wealth, they're smart. So yeah. You think like, and they're good, right? They're good?
Yeah, rich people are better than poor people.
So like you love Donald Trump, right?
No, Donald Trump is too poor for me.
No, he's very rich. Well, he's richer than you. You love him, don't you?
Only to you because you're poor. He's only rich in the poor people eyes, dude. That because poor people are too stupid to understand what is true.
Okay,
wealth.
I see what you're saying. He doesn't have the ancient Chinese dollars. He's not like me. He's not like you, the richest boy in the world. Walter Richie Rich saying.
Okay, I'm gonna fucking bring this back on track with your talk about the blue being a little limitless. You mentioned it really quickly and then we moved on, but I think that's a good point. Here's a big quote, right? In the pandemonium of Image, which is a great example of why he does not want to use this movie with Image because he thinks Image is like too messy. I present you with the universal blue. Blue, an open door to the soul, an infinite possibility becoming tangible.
It's also limitless for him because it is all he can see. His world is becoming blue. All of his existence is becoming blue. The scope of this film is like so capable of showing everything despite it being blue. Like, there's like so many layers of why the blue is limitless, right?
Yeah, and in your example, I feel like blue acts as a limiter and a delimiter, which is what I want to talk about. I think it's both, right? There's moments where the film is frustrated by the limits, but it's always juxtaposed his metaphors and poetry of the unlimitless or the infinity. Everything about the film is in that type of juxtaposition. The limit of only having a blue image is limited, but the experimentation of the film, is that an unlimited exploration?
Well, so the image is limitless. That's an interesting element. The image is limitless because there's no definition of anything on the z-axis, right? There is only up and there is only down. There is just this blank blue screen. So I was playing Subnautica, this like underwater spooky game, while I was watching this, and I was going down and I was like in a section that was like super super deep, and so nothing was like, you couldn't see anything at the bottom and you could barely see the top, and it was blue, and I was like, man, I could just be swimming down forever. And then I look over at the blue screen of the movie and I'm like, wow. Because the blue screen has no dimensions, it could be limitless.
And at the same time, you're so aware of its limits.
Yeah, because it's literally a box. It's literally a square. I mean, like, there's like, it's actually not limitless because it's just a screen.
That's why I think it's so important it's both. And both sides are so loud and extreme. I do think this film does play with time too, though. And also plays with the time being like limitless, constraining, but also like breaking up and distorted and completely fucked in a way.
Have you heard of the theory sort of like based off of this film by Bofa involving time?
No.
You don't know about the theory from Bofa? You know Bofa D's nuts? Bofa D's nuts? Bofa D's nuts in your goddamn mouth? Oh, okay. Oh, he got him, boys.
I got.
Both of these nuts.
This is like the first fucking time you've ever done a these nuts joke to me. Of course I would get caught. It fucking took me out of nowhere.
It's because normally I just like call you an asshole, but this time I made you the asshole.
Oh, so you think this is a fucking asshole thing? That talking about time is an asshole thing? Oh, movies about time. I'm so fucking
sick of them. Just like normally when I wanted to be mean to you, I'd call you an asshole. But now I'm being mean to you by making you seem like an asshole for not knowing that I was going to get you with a bow for these nuts, Joe.
Well, guess what? Words and stones will fix my bones, but words will never hurt me.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's 100%. Confucius said that, right?
I thought it was Paul Bunyan.
I thought it was Confucius and Paul Bunyan's child.
What? Kung Fu Bunyan?
It's Liu Bu was the son of Paul Bunyan and Confucius.
Speaking of Liu Bu, history, baby. Time, baby.
Time and history.
One of my favorite quotes in this film actually is when he's talking about the drips, right?
Oh, and talking about the drips and the time. The drips are a medicinal drip that he's like having basically infusions to make it so that he doesn't fucking... to try and keep him alive for as long as he can.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in this segment, the drips are juxtaposed to the metronome. For him, each metronome tick, 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 tick is a drip.
This is actually a really good bit where he talks about how Kutama Bondi instructs me to walk away from illness, but he wasn't attached to a drip. Fate is the strongest. Fate, fated, fatal. I resign myself to fate. Blind fate. The drip stings. A lump swells in my arm. Out comes the drip. An electrical shock sparks up my arm. How can I walk away with the drip attached to me? So the drip is really limiting in contrast to the blue, the infinite blue, because he literally, I mean, he's attached to a machine. He can't go anywhere, right?
Yeah, and the drip also, because it's the metronome, drags him back to sort of the reality of time. So the metronome legit times time the way we understand it. Or at least we want to understand it, right? And for me, this film is like, the chronology is so different. And sometimes he's thinking about the past. Sometimes he's imagining some imagination and some future. And so therefore, the time becomes very like round almost. While when he has to like focus on the hospital stuff, when the drip drags him out of this sort of round time he has for himself that's unlimitedless or timeless or like completely big.
There's a section where he talks about how hell on earth is a waiting room. Here I am again in the waiting room. Hell on earth is a waiting room. Here you know you are not in control of yourself, waiting for your name to be called. 71-22-13. Here you have no name. Confidentiality is nameless. I have spent some time in some waiting rooms. And it sucks. Because you really have no agency in a waiting room. Not only because you are at the beck and call of someone to call your name, but you don't have control when you're in a hospital setting. You know, you're not a doctor. You don't have the skills.
I find that actually pretty interesting too, because the hospital itself really is the limits. The only environment we ever really get explained to us is the hospital. And you can tell in the film, it's because he spends so much fucking time at this hospital. And that really is like the domination of mostly his life. In some ways, you do want to give this movie as much agency as you want, because it makes us feel better that like, oh, this movie doesn't deal with the lack of agency of death or the lack of agency of like being completely socially unjust because society doesn't want to admit AIDS. It's
when the only agency you have when it comes to your life and dying is the ability to take your own.
That's
life.
True. He does talk about that stuff.
I mean, and there's something to be said about that, right? I mean, like, that's one thing you got agency over in a lot of ways.
And isn't that like life? Life is about oscillating between limits and then the sort of belief or imagination or like this unlimited agency. Like we understand ourselves or imagine ourselves between a limit and freedom. To me, that's what is most interesting about Blue, though, or like even necropolitics, which is why I brought it up. Even though dying or talking about death feels so foreign from life sometimes, these stories, they tackle something that's so quintessential to life, and that's why this type of honest story to me is very, very important. I hope that if there's any new listeners, most of you are probably coming from, this film is a huge movie in the LGBTQ circle. So I hope you guys like what we said about it as two, okay, as one me straight person. But I have realized one thing, my internet sexuality is not the same as my un-internet sexuality.
Well, that's true. Your fantasy sexuality is very different from your actual sexuality, which I think is pretty normal. I think it's pretty normal.
I think it's normal too. Can you believe no one talks about it like that though? That's so crazy.
I think it's because people either want to make that be like, no, you're gay. And it's like, well, I mean, maybe, I don't know. Or they want to be like, they don't want to talk about it because they don't want to be gay, right? Again, it's about people want to draw lines in the sand.
Dude, I've been thinking about this so much, and I think I like dick, but I don't like masculine things. That's why I like cringe when I hear like people talking about making muscles, but I think I would enjoy sucking dick. But I just want the penis on like
a feminine person.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah. But I don't know if that's 100% true, because maybe like animated dicks are just way more cuter than the real ones.
As we all know, I am only attracted to Timothée Chalamet and the Grinch, so that's why I'm gay. And also Bruce Willis.
One day he'll do his war stories on Grindr. We'll get to hear his stories on Grindr.
Grindr sucks. Grindr makes me sad. Whenever I go on Grindr, I'm like, man, I'm gonna get assaulted or maybe murdered or both.
What?
So I
Jesus Christ.
I don't know. I think it's a gross place. I mean, it's fine. Like, there are a few people on Grindr who I know who are like totally chill and not gonna murder you. I don't know. It's a sketchy website. I think it's gross. I do not like Grindr. Having used it a couple times, I will be the first to say I do not.
Well,
like it.
If you use Grindr and you can teach Sweet how to navigate through it in a more healthy way, please let us know. So
the only people I ever interact with on Grindr are the people I know I could beat in a fight. because if you go on a date with someone and they're like 6'2", 300 pounds, if they want to fucking like assault you, if they want to like fucking get you, like what are you gonna do? But like if I go on a like Grindr date with like a like 5'2", 120-pound dude. It's like, yeah.
Just bring a fucking pepper spray or something. I don't know. That's what all the fucking girls on Tinder do.
Well, yeah, but what if you, like, don't have your pepper spray near you and you want them to get off you?
Okay, that doesn't stop girls dating, like, shitty guys on Tinder.
Look, I'm not... Look, Walter. Wait, what are you upset about? This is just how I feel. I just want to feel safer knowing I could beat someone in a fight if I'm going to go on a first date with them. That's why I only go on dates with women who are shorter and smaller than me.
Am I upset?
You are upset.
I kind of feel like you're right. I am upset.
It's like a masculinity thing again. You're triggered when I'm talking about just feeling safe. Fucking bastard. That's why I would go on a date with you, Walt, because I could fucking kick your ass in a heartbeat.
Kicking my ass is definitely about safety, and it's not toxic. Also, I think you're the type of person who gets mad when a girl tells you they don't feel safe around you.
Dude, I'm
going to
fucking go hard in the gym. Oh, talking about gym stuff, I started doing the bench press, dude. So mad. Here are my gym goals. Run a 10-minute mile, leg press 250 pounds, bench press 150 pounds. And when I get there, Walter has to get a tattoo that says, I'm a bitch.
Okay.
No,
I'm just glad that we're still talking about safety. I'm glad tattoos make you feel safe.
You don't even care about my muscles.
The more you talk about them, the more I don't care about them. In fact, the more revolting they become. I used to be in line and was happy to support, and now I'm starting to get like physically ill.
I'm going to make you work out when you come to Roanoke, and I'm going to record it. I'm going to record it and post it on Twitter.
I'll work out for a day, I guess. At the same time, it's just gonna be not a big deal. It's just, you know, we fucking work. It's like me crying. It's not a fucking big deal. We just do it.
But then
I don't have to like celebrate it, you know.
But sometimes I work. I don't know, dude.
The only things that I celebrate are my fucking pretentious movies and the porn I watch.
What a sad little man. What a small, sad little man you are.
I don't think I'm sad.
You're just little. He's just a little boy.
I like being little. I like being weak. I like not having that type of shitty. I don't like that type of masculinity. It's not my favorite.
You know, being strong is not necessarily masculine. There are plenty of strong ladies. In fact, Walter, I would say your constant referral to masculinity as being strong and muscular is an inherently sexist structure. So, get canceled, Walt.
Okay, that's fair.
Where are my buff ladies at? My buff ladies? My buff non-binary people? My buff two spirits? Where you at?
We're not saying that word, dude.
There are people who identify as two spirit. We're allowed to say it. That would be like you're not allowed to call someone trans and be like, I'm glad you know who you are.
Oh, that's a fair point.
Where are my buff people at? Let's get buff together. Smash the patriarchy. Except for me. Don't smash my part of the patriarchy because I need it to get my literature published. But after that, we can smash the patriarchy.
See, there's like a difference between like people who are buff who like just want to like beat you down and like want to win and then be able to call you like a bitch. And then there's like the difference between like someone who's really buff who just wants to like carry you and put you in a princess carry.
Well, I would do both for you.
Okay, I don't want one of those, though. That's the fucking problem.
Okay, well, that's too bad. That's too bad for you. You should have been less of a bitch.
No, I'm just gonna be, like, better at finding someone else to date instead of you.
No, I'm gonna date you all. I'm gonna beat you up, and then I'm gonna date you. I love my muscles.
I know! We've been talking about your muscles forever!
Well, I think that kind of brings us to a close. I want to thank everyone for listening, and remember, if you're going to watch a movie, muscles! if you're gonna watch,
can I stop you really quickly? There's actually a really interesting documentary called Muscle.
Well, we watched that steroid documentary together. That was pretty good. Better, faster, stronger. Yeah.
Which I think is like an amazing deconstruction of toxic masculinity. But the great philosopher Tori disproved me by saying it's just accidental.
Yeah, but Tori's like a fucking cuck. Tori's wrong about that. It does deconstruct masculinity. He's stupid.
All right, so Muscle. It's by that guy who fucking directed that movie where the girl like fucking knives out her vagina lips and eats them.
Jesus Christ.
Okay, so this film, let me read out the synopsis. You're gonna hate it, but it might be fun to bring on the podcast. Who knows? Ryuzuki, an editor of Muscle Magazine, which features photographs of men with sculpted bodies, becomes involved with a man named Katami. Their affair soon becomes dominated by a sadomasochistic game. 1 year ahead, Ryuzuki is released from jail and goes to search for Katami. While he's searching, his imagination gets dominated by films like Salo.
We're not gonna bring that on the podcast.
I heard something like this movie, it like romanticizes cream cheese and amputation at the same time. It's gay sexy. And it's just called Muscle.
Man, you want to know what I'm tired of? Is you being like, you know, my favorite thing is like jizz in an asshole. You know, like that's my equivalent of muscle frustration, but it's fine.
But this is a movie.
My muscles are a movie.
Look, you reference your muscles through a movie next time and I won't complain. I guarantee you. Know what we're going to be doing? We are a movie podcast.
That's true. And
if
and,
you haven't know, forgotten.
If you haven't forgotten. Just remember, if you're going to watch a movie, do it with the lights on.